afternoon. It's Friday the 24th of February 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Vanessa Bailey. We're going to get straight into this. We've got a lot to cover, and we're going to start off with Europol. Now, about a year ago, Europol, to much fanfare, launched the European Migrant Smuggling Centre. I have to admit, the name grabbed me, Vanessa, because European Migrant Smuggling Centre is not prevention of migrant smuggling. It's not, the word prevention isn't using it. But so what is this? Well, of course, they say that they're there to prevent smuggling of migrants. At the time, they warned that human trafficking was a booming industry. They called it the fastest growing criminal market in Europe, with refugee smuggling a major source of income. For whom? For them? I don't know. It's now a year gone past, and they have released their 1 year on report, and they're saying 17,400 new suspected migrant smugglers have been identified. They're saying the increased involvement of organised criminal networks in facilitating illegal immigration in recent times call for an enhanced and coordinated response from the European law enforcement agencies. Europol was tasked with strengthening its capabilities and launched the European Migrant Smuggling Centre in February 2016. During the first year, 45 migrant smuggling specialists and analysts comprehensively supported European police and border control authorities in coordinating highly complex cross-border anti-smuggling operations. This is great. Here is the man in charge, Dimitris of... I'm not even going to try it.
Dimitris Avramopoulos.
Oh, thank you. European Commissioner for Migration, Home Affairs and Citizenship. He said, migrant smuggling is a phenomenon that transcends national borders and can only be eradicated through effective partnerships across and beyond the European Union. From the very beginning, the European Migrant Smuggling Centre with Europol has played a central role for the EU and its immediate neighbourhood in successfully fighting, disrupting and apprehending criminal migrant smuggling networks. Well, is that true? We're going to have a look at that in a second. Now, they have published their one-year report. Here it is on screen. They're saying that it's detailing 12,000 operational messages submitted via Europol's secure communications network, representing a 34% increase compared to 2015. So that's good. They're sending lots of messages backwards and forwards. That's the top statistic that they wanted to mention. They're saying that these contain data on over 17,400 new suspected migrant smugglers and helped launch 2,057 new international investigations. Nearly a quarter of these investigations related to identity and or document fraud, as investigators reported detecting 2,589 identity documents that have been forged, counterfeit or reported as lost or stolen. In addition, 22 print shops or document forgery factories were identified and dismantled. And in the introduction to this, there is nothing at all about people. Nothing at all about people. So this is all a bit sad. Now, they also, we should point out, recently announced that they had identified 10,000 victims of child sexual exploitation, many of them who had been trafficked. And when I asked them how many convictions had come about from that, their response to me was that they don't hold those statistics. So, you know, what is the point of Europol under these circumstances? And Vanessa, what this looks like to me is an industry mm-hmm. with a business model that's very similar to the war on drugs. Yep. So you set up, you facilitate drug trafficking in the case of the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. The money flows, of course, are supporting the banking industry. And of course, you throw a few billion back at law enforcement so that you can run a PR campaign which pretends to be doing something about drug trafficking. This is exactly the same situation, I think, with humans.
Absolutely. I mean, we're seeing a tremendous increase. We were talking about it this morning in what is effectively, for want of a better word, the harvesting of human beings. And we know for a fact, I haven't got the information in front of me, but there are European-funded NGOs involved in this human being trafficking.
Absolutely. So let's just remind ourselves then of this report, because, of course, what happens to these people, these children, when they reach their destination? Some of them come to the UK, where they go missing. And this, of course, happens right across Europe. So this report we mentioned a couple of months ago from an NGO called ECPAT UK and also a charity called Missing People, saying that 167 of 590 children suspected or identified as child trafficking victims in the year from September 2014 to 2015 vanished from foster and care homes across the UK. 593 of 4,744 unaccompanied children placed under the protection of local authorities went missing at least once in the same period. Of 760 trafficked or unaccompanied children who disappeared from care, 207 had never been found. And the majority of child trafficking victims who vanished from care, well, they mentioned the countries that they were from, including Afghanistan, Eritrea, Albania, Vietnam. It's not just the Middle East, it's other countries as well. And of course, we must also remind ourselves of the 2012 all-party parliamentary group for runaway and missing children and adults, talking about looked after children and care leavers. This was headed by Anne Coffey MP, if we remember. They were describing this as a scandal going on involving children missing from care. And of course, this is ultimately what happens. These children and adults being trafficked throughout Europe, some of them ending up in the care system from where they disappear out the other side. Nobody seems to know. And it looks like there is an industry built up around this.
And I think we also need to be looking very hard at who is campaigning for open borders. Because effectively, open borders means free lanes for child trafficking.
Right. Okay, so we're going to put a bit of meat on this now. And we're going to start off with this organisation, Amici del Bambini. This is an Italian organisation. Give us a bit of background to this.
Well, we've only just sort of recently been had this highlighted to us. Amici dei Bambini already have a history of child trafficking in Congo, in Bulgaria, and they're now setting up in Syria. If we look back to their history, we see, as I say, that they have been accused within Italian courts of child trafficking. If we look at where they are focused in Syria, for example, they are predominantly in Aleppo, Homs, Damascus countryside, and Idlib. Now, these are predominantly not only the terrorist-held areas, so Nusra Front, ISIS, the various other extremist factions, but also where the UK-funded and US-funded NATO state and Gulf state-funded white helmets are also based. So it's interesting that this organisation, which claims to have affiliations with Syrian NGOs, is embedded, like so many others, in terrorist-held areas, opposition-held areas inside Syria, and that are also supported by the white helmets. Now, they claim to have helped 35,000 children. Helped, I mean, there's no description of what that help entails on their website. So 35,000 children in the last 4 years, and they're putting out figures of 6 million children in need of humanitarian help inside Syria.
Okay, and well, let's have a look at this article then from L'Espresso, because some people that have been supporting them in the past no longer want to.
No.
So who is this?
Espresso is Melissa Satta, and I believe you've got the body of the article to the Against Child Trafficking, which is a small independent NGO that is genuinely investigating and preventing a large sector of child trafficking.
Right. So what this article says is Melissa Satta has suspended its cooperation with I'll Be Friends of Children. Launch of the interrogations of the Guardi de Finanza for the scandal on international adoptions. These days, witnesses were heard in various offices from Lombardy to Sicily, and so it goes on. Basically, they're taking a step back from this organisation. And at the end of this article, it says, even UNICEF, after the scandal in Congo on adoptions, cancelled their funding to ALBI of over €245,000.
Yeah.
So this is widely recognised that there's a problem with this organisation.
It's very widely recognised. I mean, if we even go back to Romania also, there is footage of Amici dei Bambini, again, campaigning for Romanian adoptions to be internationalised And Romania, of course, was protecting its children against child trafficking fundamentally through international illegal or illegitimate international adoption. So it was very clear even back then during the Romanian issues that Amici De Bambini was campaigning internationally for open borders and international adoptions.
Okay, so let's have a look at Kids Paradise here. This organization linked.
Yeah, Kids Paradise, basically Amici De Bambini claimed to work with four Syrian, and they stress the fact that they are supposedly Syrian NGOs inside Syria, to combat the children's crisis in Syria. And one of the first ones we looked at is this organization, Kids Paradise. And if you go to the partners of Kids Paradise, you'll see there very clearly that Amici De Bambini is shown. But also one of the more disturbing partnerships here is this organization. Already the symbol to me is particularly suggestive and not in a positive way, is Human Wire, which is, again, based in the areas that we've been talking about. Supporting children, refugees, one-to-one. But if we move on to this new innovative way to help refugees, this is particularly disturbing. This is basically a child advertisement page asking for donations that will go directly to individual children. So the child is named and photographed and money is taken in for those children directly.
Well, in fact, there's an app for that.
Yeah. And this is the worrying factor. If we look at the actual Human Wire concept, from what we can understand, it's putting the sponsor or the donator in touch directly with the child. Now, I mean, this, you're probably more versed in the legal aspects of this than I am, but it strikes me as extraordinary that these children are being put in touch. What are the checks? I mean, they claim that they do make checks, that they do take passport prints and so on of the people involved.
But at a time when there's so much in the news about grooming of children on the internet via
Absolutely.
Chat boxes and various other things, we're now putting adults who are providing money directly to children, apparently.
And to chosen child. They're given the photograph, they're given
and
the
direct
details.
Contact, yeah. Direct contact.
Yeah. So the child's privacy is completely violated through this process.
And one of the other organizations was Hadaya.
Yeah. And bear in mind that Amici De Bambini is claiming that they're only working or that they are working with Syrian NGOs. Hadaya, again, is another. It follows very similar format to the other four, all focusing on children, all promoting the various children centers in the terrorist held areas. Again, we have to focus on that. These children are in areas not protected by the government, but actually held by terrorist organizations. So one wonders, I mean, we saw in East Aleppo, a French charity, Syria charity, basically doing the same thing, advertising children for donorship and sponsorship. Where are those children now? Mm. Where have they gone as East Aleppo was evacuated? How many of those children were taken into these other areas that are now being covered by these various NGOs?
Right, so you wanted to highlight a quote from this. Hadaya is financially sponsored by Elbin Charities, and you wanted to highlight Elbin Charities in particular?
Well, because basically the claim is that, again, that these are Syrian NGOs. But as we've proven time and time again, very few of these NGOs working in the terrorist-held areas are effectively Syrian in the sense that the majority of their donors and sponsors come from nations that effectively have a vested interest in regime change in Syria. And this organization, which is financing Hadaya, is actually based in North Carolina. So again, we have a United States involvement and backing behind one of these child-helping NGOs.
Okay, well, just before we move on from this, I just wanted to highlight Amnesty International again, and this is a tweet from Maria Serrano Martin, because I find this a bit disturbing. We've seen mainstream media reports, which are very similar in the Daily Mail and other newspapers, But here we have a tweet saying unaccompanied minors trying to leave Bulgaria, unprotected by a dysfunctional system where no one takes responsibility. And what we have here is an image showing what look like young adults, mm. not children. Yeah. And I just want to remind everybody what the ECPAT UK and Missing People charity said, because they were specifically talking about children missing from foster homes and the care system. And they were not talking about young adults that were coming to this country. The image that is being presented is that unaccompanied minors are, you know, 16, 17, 18 year olds. And this is particularly dangerous because what it's doing is diverting people into the sort of whole immigration, should Muslims be coming to the country argument, and away from children disappearing into sex slavery potentially. But the point is, we don't know, because of course people like Tim Farron don't want to consider where these children are going, and don't want to sort of take any responsibility for them. So Amnesty International, once again, proving to be something other than they pretend to be.
Certainly. You know, they have a proven record of supporting NATO state and Gulf state activities in globally.
Yeah.
So this is another demonstration, and possibly a murkier demonstration of it.
Okay, well, let's move on then, because today is the funeral of Vitaly Churkin, Russian representative to the United Nations Security Council, and that is going on at the moment. Sergei Lavrov saying today, we're saying farewell to our friend, an outstanding diplomat. Vitaly was the best professional. Mm. But still, as far as I'm aware, I haven't seen anything, still nothing from Matthew Rycroft, nothing from his colleague, apparently, nothing from
extraordinary.
Boris Johnson, nothing from the Foreign Office, nothing from Theresa May.
I mean, it's an extraordinary breach of diplomacy, if nothing else.
Yes.
Just before we move on from that, 21st Century Wire has actually collated a number of tributes made by the general public to Vitaly Churkin, including Syrian nationals. And I would just like to really quickly read one from somebody inside Syria. Churkin was Syrian more than a lot of Syrians themselves, fearless in defending Syria, a hero in the time of traitors. Churkin was the only one who raised his hand high in the sky in the Security Council six times to avoid invasion of Syria and to protect Syrian civilians against the American killing machine. From the heart of Damascus, we are praying for your soul to rest in peace, and we grieve you as a great hero in Syria, and we grieve you with your family, because according to my mother, who's 60 years old, when she read the news of your death, she cried and said, a true Syrian hero fell during this dirty war against us, and may your soul rest in peace. That comes from somebody that I know based in Damascus. And that was the general feeling from the majority of Syrians. A great loss, actually.
Okay. Okay. Right. Vanessa, you are under attack.
Yes.
So let's just put this up. Apparently you're an atrocity denier.
I'm an atrocity denier because this was actually issued after my talk on Syria that I gave in Bristol last week, and was followed up by another talk in Birmingham that was equally attended by various intervention supporters, let's be kind, and say that they're in favour of regime change in Syria and intervention, which effectively means that they support the NATO and Gulf state extremist factions trying to impose regime change in Syria against the will of the majority of the Syrian people. And apparently that means that I'm denying atrocities. And the threat at the Bristol talk, as they were thrown out, was basically that all atrocity deniers should be hunted down. So that effectively it's a threat.
It's quite a nasty threat. You should be hunted down.
And that terminology is being used by pretty much all of them affiliated to the Syria Solidarity UK. And part of their fury was as a result of this cartoon, which was created by an amazing cartoonist, Rob Amos, which showed myself and Ava Bartlett shooting down the very propaganda that these people are producing. So, you know, effectively, I have to look at it as a compliment in the sense that they consider me or us to be enough of a threat, that they are starting now to take an interest in physically threatening us.
Okay, well, let's just advertise your next talk, which is in London at the Marx Memorial Library, 37A Clerkenwell Green.
Yeah.
That's on the 1st of March, begins at 7 p.m. It's entitled Aleppo, Fall or Liberation. Are you expecting some of these people to turn up to that?
Yeah, definitely, because the Syria Solidarity UK movement is pretty much based in London, so I'm fully expecting them to turn up. So if anybody's in London, it would be great to see you, one thing, but it would also be great if you came along to support what is effectively the true situation inside Syria and to support the Syrian people against these kind of true atrocity deniers.
Okay, well, we're going to move on to Yemen now, and but before we do, we've mentioned Matthew Rycroft once. We've got a little video clip of Matthew Rycroft as a lead into the Yemen section. So let's watch that. It's just about a minute long, and then we'll discuss it.
Do you think in Yemen, the airstrike campaign contributes to the humanitarian crisis, bombing of ports, etc.?
In all four of these cases, there is a mixture of factors. Clearly, in Yemen, there can be no military solution. There must be a political settlement, and we strongly support the UN in seeking to achieve that, and we support the UN in ensuring humanitarian access to the people who need it in Yemen.
The only speaker here on the stairs, on the famous stairs to the council, the stairway to heaven, was UK Ambassador Mr.
Okay, so what do you think of Matthew Rycroft?
Well, I mean, you know, it's extraordinary. We've seen such extraordinary displays of, I'm not even quite sure what to call it, arrogance and ignorance from Matthew Rycroft, including his walking out on the Syrian permanent representative at the UN. When he started speaking, which can only be described as schoolyard tactics. But on Yemen, I mean, the British regime is so at fault, supplying 3 billion in arms to the Saudi coalition, standing basically in the control and command center in Riyadh, along with United States military experts, determining targets that we know to be predominantly civilian targets. I mean, we've seen a dreadful upsurge in the targeting of what is left of schools and hospitals inside Yemen.
Well, let's have a few statistics here. What's that? 15 airports, 319 stations. 1,500 bridges, 400,000 homes, government facilities, mosques, schools, health facilities. So it goes on. So this little infographic showing the statistics of what has been destroyed.
Yeah.
And, of course, we've seen this in Libya, we've seen this in Syria, we've seen this in Iraq. It's the infrastructure that people need to do their day-to-day business, which is being targeted.
Yeah.
So, you know, the key point here is this is not a civil war, but it continues to be a war which the mainstream media, fake, calls a civil war. Mm. But drastically under reports.
Absolutely, and endorsed and advocated by the British government, who still consider Saudi Arabia to be an important ally, despite the fact that they are effectively carrying out an illegal war of aggression and fundamentally a genocide of the Yemeni people, a sectarian genocide of the Yemeni people.
Well, look, the next couple of images may be disturbing to some, but we're not going to apologise for it because we've got to understand what is being done here. So the Yemen Post newspaper, another child killed, Saudi airstrike, attacked family vehicle, killing child and injuring nine. But of course, it's the starvation, which is one of the really huge problems here, because no food, no medicine, no hope. And medicine, we shouldn't forget, because people are dying as a result of a lack of medicine.
Absolutely. And if you move on to the next slides, I'll run through the main points. And if anybody wants to follow what is really happening on the ground in Yemen, I do recommend Arwa Wright, with whom I worked at the UN in March 2016. Now, when I run through their statement to the UNHRC, the 34th session, which was the end of 2016, basically, I mean, I think we've explained this before, UN Resolution 2140 and 2216 has fundamentally inflicted the humanitarian blockade upon 27 million Yemeni people. It's increased food. Basically, what it is an embargo, which was effectively put on five named individuals, but is being exploited by the Saudi coalition to effectively, collectively punish 27 million Yemeni people, including, of course, millions of children. And so we've seen food insecurity, a 33% increase since pre-war 2014. We've seen 2.2 million babies and children are acutely malnourished. 500,000 children, which sadly is exactly the number that died in Iraq, of course, severe acute malnutrition, so on the edge of death, as we saw with those photographs. And that is a frightening 63% increase since late 2015. 55% of hospitals, clinics, and health units have been shut down, predominantly by bombing, of course, but also through lack of supply of medicines. And the Saudi coalition has imposed a blockade on commercial flights into the main airport in Sana'a and has closed down Hodeidah port for the last 6 months. And that has severely reduced ability. You can see the port there is to the west of Yemen. But that's severely reduced ability to supply medicines that were coming in on the commercial flights because they need to be refrigerated, for example. Mm. So those are now, it's impossible to get them into Yemen. Incoming ships have been diverted to Jeddah or to another port in or to a port in Djibouti, which adds further delays of 3 months of supplies getting into Yemen. And even when they do head for Yemen, we then have the UN again turning the screws on the Yemeni people by introducing the UN verification and inspection mechanism, which is further exploited by the Saudi coalition to ensure further delays, which results, of course, in the perishing of goods, et cetera, and sometimes of them not even arriving. Hodeidah port, which we showed, handled 80% of food and medical imports prior to the war. Even now, if the boats do get into Hodeidah, which currently is shut down and has been regularly bombed by the Saudi coalition purposefully, they've destroyed all the lifting equipment, cranes, and so on. So even if those boats get to Hodeidah, the amount of time it takes to offload any equipment and any humanitarian aid takes three times as long or possibly more than before. And I just want to recount one story which I think exemplifies the hideous nature of this siege, which is effectively being supported and endorsed by the United Nations and by the UN Security Council. I was told of the story of Mohammed, who had a kidney transplant in 1998. He was 10 years old. 18 years later, in 2016, after that kidney transplant for those 18 years had given him improved quality of life, basically that kidney is now being rejected by his body because his immunosuppressant medicines are no longer available. And there are over 5,000 patients currently with kidney failure, heart disease, and so on that are dying because simply because they cannot get some of the most basic medicines into Yemen.
But Vanessa, this can't be right because the Department for International Development says that they're pushing in millions and millions of pounds into Yemen to prevent this type of thing.
Well, I mean, this is extraordinary. I mean, this is the callous cynicism of our governments and our government-supported and sponsored NGOs in the sense that they create a crisis and they then claim that they want to rush in with public money to save the people that they've effectively starved or bombed or deprived in one way, shape or form.
It is fascinating. We mentioned this report from the Department for International Development a couple of days ago, but it is staggering, and people, you know, I find it incredible if anybody finds this a coincidence, but this isn't the case that the Department for International Development has suddenly decided that in the future, or it's beginning now, they're going to start putting money into these areas. But they, on this infographic, they have northeastern Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen, countries which are all in a state of crisis that have been receiving Department for International Development money for some time. And I asked the question a couple of days ago, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. This indicates to me that Department for International Development money is going to probably NGOs on the ground, which are creating the crisis. Is that unfair?
No, that's absolutely correct.
Let's just remind ourselves what Priti Patel said. She said, in times of crisis, the world looks to Britain, not just for our work on the ground, but also for our leadership internationally. So that should make us all feel terribly good about ourselves.
It should make us deeply ashamed of our government.
Yes. Okay, well, let's move on to Syria then. This article, 130 bodies found in Syrian mass grave, 130 fighters shot execution style or beheaded by rival jihadists have been found in mass graves in northwest Syria, according to France 24 here. A monitoring group and rebel sources said on Thursday. Grim discovery comes nearly a week after clashes in Idlib province between various jihadist groups. We're seeing again today suicide bombings, which appear to be they appear to be targeting each other. This seems to be potentially an interesting move by the Syrian government to sort of corral these people all in a very tight group, because they seem to be doing the government's job for them.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess it's kind of inevitable. I mean, we knew even prior to the evacuation from East Aleppo that within East Aleppo itself, the various extremist and militant factions were fighting among themselves, not on any ideological basis, because really ideologically they meshed together, but on, you know, for equipment, for territory, for influence. And another quite interesting story in the same or in a similar area is that one group, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is al-Qaeda linked, basically besieged an ISIS-backed group, Liwa al-Aqsa, in Khan Shahun and Morik. And fundamentally, what has now happened is that there's been a mass evacuation of the ISIS-backed group towards Raqqa, so joining the ISIS forces in Raqqa. And prior to leaving, of course, very similar to the extremist groups leaving East Aleppo, they burned all equipment so that the in-situ terrorist groups didn't have access to new equipment. So I think what we're seeing is, you know, gangs and counter-gangs. We're seeing gang warfare basically going on right now. And to some extent, let's hope that they eliminate themselves. Because, you know, that's, it would solve a lot of problems.
Yes. Okay. This article from you on 21st Century War, an exclusive, Raj Saleh's terrorist connections within White Helmet leadership.
Well, I mean, this is a very interesting fact. The battles that are going on right now are very much focused around, obviously, Idlib, but Khan Shahun, which is a major important strategic area inside Idlib. But there, in that area, in Khan Shahun, there is a White Helmet Center. And that White Helmet Center is run by Mustafa al-Haj Yusuf, who is best friends of Raj Saleh, as seen in various photographs with Raj Saleh. So this is a White Helmet leader with connections to Raj Saleh, who's about to walk up the red carpet at the Oscars on Sunday. And this is a guy, Mustafa al-Haj Yusuf, who has basically called for the shelling of civilians in Damascus during elections in 2014 on his social media pages. He's declared allegiance to both ISIS and to Ahrar al-Sham. In fact, he's calling for unity of the extremist named terrorist groups in Idlib and various other extremist statements that he's put out on his social media accounts tie him very directly to extremist and sectarian violent ideology. And this is a very close colleague of Raj Saleh, who has already, you know, through our various articles, has been proven to have connections to al-Qaeda. So this is deepening the evidence of those al-Qaeda connections. And this is the guy that has been given special clearance to come into the United States to attend the Oscars ceremony for the White Helmet documentary. I mean, we're smiling, but seriously, I mean, this is a world that has gone seriously insane. I mean, potentially an al-Qaeda propaganda film is about to win an Oscar.
Yep. Brilliant. Okay, well, look, we're going to, I think this is the last article we've got today, but this story has been doing the rounds. This is a bit of a fake news story in itself. It is a brilliant fake news story. So the Metro, the Mail, we also have got there the Sun and the Independent, all covering this female cyclist catcalled by man in van, chases him down and exacts her revenge. Unfortunately for the mainstream press. This turned out to be a complete hoax.
It turned out to be a complete hoax. In fact, if we go to the slide of Jungle Creations, who made the movie, where they actually put out a notice.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where they apologized, I think, for the fake film.
Right.
But I think they tried to sort of distance themselves from responsibility for having made a hoax story. But we then, Charles Shoebridge on Twitter actually messaged me and mentioned to me that on an absolute hunch, he'd gone to look at what else this organization had made. And of course, we found, or rather Charles found, that they'd been working with the Syria campaign, who is basically the PR company behind the White Helmets, on producing a White Helmets promotional movie. So interesting that an organization which claims, I believe, to be the sixth biggest in the world has produced a movie for the White Helmets and has recently been caught out basically creating a hoax movie.
And it's had, 49 million views, 803,000 shares, 1.3 million likes, 80,000 comments.
Mm.
But, of course, if you've got the mainstream media just prepared to publish whatever you produce without any due diligence or any kind of background checks, whether it be the White Helmets or somebody cycling in through London, then you've no problem raising those kinds of views.
No, and it raised a huge amount of money. I think it was $105,000 for the White Helmets. And also, I called them just before coming on here, and I put it to them that I was very interested in who exactly had contacted them to make the White Helmet movie. Had they gone through any verifying process of the clips that they used for the White Helmets, and were they aware that there was extensive documentation and evidence leading to the connections of the White Helmets to Al-Qaeda, a terrorist group in Syria, at which point I have to say they couldn't get me off the phone fast enough.
So let's look at who they are then. So Jungle Creations is the sixth biggest media company in the world. We've achieved this by creating 10 channels that live on social media. We create and curate the best content on the internet to entertain and engage our audience of over 21 million followers. We then work with the biggest brands in the world to create content we know their audience would love. Content they watch, share, enjoy, and act upon. We are the most effective way to interact with millions of people. So that's brilliant.
Well, I mean, that effectively says it all, really, doesn't it? It describes the White Helmet PR apparatus perfectly. They're based in Shoreditch in London, by the way, so they're not that far away from us either.
Okay, and this is another part of their website showing, again, the Syria campaign front and centre, actually, of their the videos they want to promote.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of the program today. Thank you very much for joining us, Vanessa. You'll be back with me on Monday, I believe. Well, we hope you all have a great weekend. We will see you at 1 p.m. as usual on Monday. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.